Thank you, Dave. Please join me in welcoming our speaker tonight, Mary Ann from Medford, Oregon.
My name is Mary Ann. I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
And I guess you give your sobriety date here. Mine is the 27th day of February, 1981. And from that, you people, I thank. Anyway, sorry. Can you hear me? Am I too far away? I seem like I'm, am I close enough to hear? Okay. I want to thank Chris and his beautiful wife, Barbara, for bringing me up here. I got to tell you, my sponsor, Virginia, is speaking at the Tigard. Is that how you say it? Yeah. Oh, if you say that, you get in trouble. So anyway, she's at that meeting tonight, so we got to ride up here together, chatting all the way without any husbands to take our inventory. I told my husband, Otto, as I pulled out of the drive, we're going to have that air conditioner on all the way up and all the way back. My sponsor and I are old and fat, and we run around with those skinny husbands that sit in the front and hide all the air. So I had my dress up and the wind blowing, and it was heaven. And I'm going to do the same thing on the way home. Anyway, I want to welcome all the newcomers. I love to be in meetings where I see a lot of newcomers. That tells me this thing keeps working. You know, because if it was just me and my husband coming to meetings every night, I'd get awful tired of hearing him. And I know he'd be tired of hearing me. So welcome to the new people. And I got to tell you that because I'm alcoholic, I've tended to do things bass-ackwards all my life. So at the grand old age of 61 years old, I'm starting to read children's books. Something I picked up the other day that I've heard about all my life and I have never taken the time to read is the Chronicles of Narnia. Okay? And the spiritual story in that has blown me away. But in the very first book, the magician's nephew. I'm reading this story and it's this children's book and I'm enjoying it. And the next thing I know, God speaks to me through the pages. God comes to me in the written word so many times, and maybe that's because I'm a writer and that's where I keep my head. But for the newcomers, I want to tell you what I found. And I think that this is our gift to you tonight. And in that book that I'm reading, it talks about these two children and a couple of adults and a horse. They step into a new world by accident, by sheer dumb luck. They walk into a dark place. They have no idea where they are. And it opens up, and they find out that they're in this great void, a place of great blackness. There's no sound. There's no light. There is absolute nothingness. And as they stand there and try to figure out what the hell has happened to them and how they came to be here, a voice begins to sing a love song. And as this love song comes out towards these children, suddenly stars appear. And the stars are so filled with this sound that they begin to sing. And the moon comes. And suddenly there is night and light. And the stars go up into the heavens. And the song they're singing goes with them. And as this great voice that is filling these children continues, a world comes into being. Suddenly there's trees and there's plants and there's rocks and there's grass. And water begins to bubble by. And all of a sudden animals begin to come out. And this great voice is going inside these children, and they are absolutely transfixed by the sound that they are hearing. Now, some of those adults that are with those children, the witch, she can't stand it. It is so frightening to her, this beautiful sound, this creation song, that she runs away. One of the other adults cannot believe that this can be happening, that this lion can be singing. And he shuts his ears to the song and says, I refuse to believe. But for the ones that believe, they see this wonderful Aslan. And, of course, Aslan is God in this book, or higher power, if you will. And newcomers, this is what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. These people that took coins tonight, these people that you're sitting beside, they are singing you a new world. They are bringing you out of that darkness into this beautiful place of love song. And that's what happened for me, and that's why I know it is true. And so I want to welcome you, and I hope you don't run away. I know some of you won't be able to do it. I know some of you, this is not your time. I know some of you will deny what you hear here. But for those of you that can hear this song and be filled with it, welcome to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the beauty that's inside of it. Now, I've got to tell you that I do not know if I've ever worked the steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous correctly. I know that I have done my very level best to attempt them over and over again until I have found a modicum of peace. And I know today at 24 years sober that I stand at the 12th step of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that step says to me, I speak only for me. I have no idea what the steps speak to you. The step of the 12th step says to me that I must be about my Father's business. And so tonight my job is to stand here in my dress, and tomorrow night I'll be sitting there in my sandals with my shorts on and listening to somebody else. All I know is they taught me you never say no to an AA request, even if you want to throw up in your shoes right now. Now, I got to tell you, I'm not an exciting drunk. I'm much more exciting sober than I ever was drunk. I don't know what makes me alcoholic, but I believe a long time ago, when my mother and I were still in the ethers, that there's a part of me that was missing. And my mother, who was this great spiritual giant, said to me, "Give me that one, because maybe I can bring her along." And I don't know what was wrong with me. I read in a book one time about angels, and it said just before we're born, in that split second before we shoot out of our mother's womb, a cavern angel, and I have no idea what a cavern angel is, puts their finger to our lips and says, "Shh, don't tell what you know, and don't tell where you came from." And I don't know if my angel was working overtime and was really tired and maybe pressed a little too hard. This is why we all have this cleft under our nose. This is why none of us can remember where we came from. All I know is when I got here, I had no feeling of divine. There was no spark of divinity in me. And now this holy mother that I had would take me to her church, to her holy place, to her holy people. And it filled my mother and my father and my brothers. It filled every fiber of their being, because that's where God comes in. Down to your DNA. All we are is tuning forks. And God is the great love song. And usually, when we're born, my God, we echo him. But what happened for me? I'm tone deaf, I guess. But while I lived in my mother and my father's home and I did the things that they asked me to do, I was okay. I certainly was not an emotionally or spiritually well woman. But my mother made sure that I got to the sacraments. My mother made sure that I was at Mass on Sunday, and I was at the Rosary on Tuesday, and I was at the Novena on Wednesday. My mother was probably the holiest woman since the Virgin Mary. My mother's lips were always moving in prayer. My mother had something she called the flying novena, and you said this thing for 9 days straight. And I got to tell you, I believe in the power of prayer. My mother, there are people walking on this earth today that are healed because my mother prayed whatever was wrong with them out. There are men with jobs and families today because my mother and her flying novena, she kept it in her pocket, her rosary was always hanging out of this one. Can you imagine what she thought of this child she got stuck with? This child that just could not fit in at any length. At 19 years old, I met the magic weenie. And I got to tell you, ladies, he was. And I married the magic weenie, and we moved out to Corona, California, which is a little tiny suburb. And when you're Catholic and you're married to a magic weenie, the first thing you do is you begin filling up that house with babies, and that's what we were doing. And we had three boys in rapid succession. And I got to tell you, I was okay for that first baby, but somewhere with that second baby that came right on top of that first baby, I found the biggest hole in the world in me. I would look at my friends, and I would look in their home, and I would see how they lived their life, and this hole in me got wider and wider. And somewhere when I was pregnant with my second boy, Keith, I had my first drink of alcohol, beer. And the reason I drank beer is because that's all we could afford. And I got to tell you, I know there's alcoholics that they take that first drink and they are loose. They have found that which they seek. And that was not mine. I took my first drink of alcohol and I didn't like it. I thought, of course, beer is terrible, let's face it. And I passed it on to the magic weenie. But see, this is what makes me alcoholic. You know, I don't like bell peppers. And I don't have to keep eating bell peppers to prove to myself I don't like bell peppers. With alcohol, every night, I'd open that can of beer, take two swallows, pass it off to the magic weenie. But one day it happened for me. One day I got that alcohol in me, and that thing that AA people talk about happened for me. I got high. I got bubbly. I became 6 foot tall, red-haired, and green-eyed. I went to bed that night, and I had to put my foot on the floor because the room was spinning. It was just adorable. My husband thought I was so cute, you know. I went to my first parties high, and everybody adored me because I was the life of the party. So this wonderful elixir that I have found that is doing all these things for me, well, wouldn't you drink more of it? And I don't know where I crossed the line, but I know it happened for me. Our book talks about this invisible line that we step across into alcoholism. And I drank in that house for 17 years. And I will tell you this. Had you walked into my home 15, 12, 10 years into my drinking, you would have seen the line I crossed. Because this nice Catholic kid that my mother had raised, my mother with the immaculate house and the wonderful meals, when you walked into my house, you could see the disease of alcoholism. Something was sitting on the kitchen table that I had had for dinner the night before, and then I had drank myself into a stupor, so the pork chops were congealing on these plates. I wish I had a nickel for everything I threw out because it was too hard to wash. The carpet on my kitchen, in my living room, when I dusted it, when I swept it, I had a vacuum in one hand and a scissor in the other because the string would suck up in the vacuum. The vacuum would stop, I'd take a drink, cut the string, pull it out, take a drink, and continue vacuuming. I had a light fixture. I like to call it a chandelier, but it's a light fixture. When I'm in Beverly Hills, it's a chandelier, but it, for you guys, it's a light fixture. And there were cobwebs from that light fixture to the center of the room. All it took was something to get up there and dust it down. And I was so dark by that time. I was so deep into the throes of alcoholism, I couldn't do it. The wallpaper in my bedroom my uncle had put up there, and it would begin to a little spot he had missed with the glue. All it would have taken was 2 seconds up there with a little bit of glue and put it back together. And I could not do it. And in time, that wallpaper began peeling off the wall, just like my insides were peeling apart. I had a little brown chair that I sat in, that I drank in. I drank tall cans of Miller Lite. I drank light beer because I was putting on a little weight, you know. But I found out something. If you drink 80 gallons of light beer, it still puts weight on you. I used to go home from work, sit in that little chair, put on Richard Simmons and drink beer and wonder why the weight wasn't coming off. I had my tall silver can of beer and I had my ashtray that was this high with cigarettes, and I sat there for 17 years and my life went away and I was beginning to dissolve. There was nothing left in me. See, there has to be a God part of you. Our book talks about that lack of power being our dilemma. Everything about us needs to grow. My hair grows, my nails grows, God knows my hips grows, I know. But see, our soul needs to grow too. Somehow we must find our spirit, our soul, in order for that thing to grow too. And I couldn't do it. I believe the only way we ever die, the only way we ever drop our body, is finally our soul gets big enough that the body can no longer house it. And we kick it off and we go to be where we need to be. But I'm sitting there and I got this little hard, hard, tiny spot in me. And there's nothing left. And I got these three boys I'm raising. And I got to tell you, boys and girls, I see stuff on television now where pregnant women, they don't drink, they don't smoke, they don't do anything. They don't get permanent. Now, maybe that information was out there in the 60s. I think maybe I was probably too drunk to do it. I know today there is a loving God because I birthed three sons. And those last two, I drank with my second son and with my third boy. I drank the day I birthed him. And my boys are in their right minds. They have healthy bodies. They are productive members of society. And I had nothing to do with it. And I am grateful to this thing that you people taught me was a source of kindness and love, that he brought my three boys into this world and way out of my help. And these three kids, nobody's understanding my drinking anymore. The magic weenie, he says, you know, where did my wife go? He's at the point, I can see him yet. He had very distinctive jawline, and I would be telling the same story for the 15th time. You know how we always think it's new? And I could see him working those, and he'd say, you already told me that. Yeah, I know, you told me that. So then what happens is you can't talk anymore because you don't know what you've said. So now I am alone and I am black and now I can't even talk to anybody. And I got these three sons and they don't understand it. And they're coming to me, my oldest boy, Brian, he's quite an artist. And he says, Mom, you got to come down to the school. You know, I did this draftsman's project and I've won the blue ribbon and it's going to be on display and I need you to come down. And okay, Brian, honey, get your old mom a beer and I'll be down to see your award. And I got to tell you, that boy's 41 and I never have been down to see his award. The second boy, that Keith, he's an athlete. Man, he's a great ball player. And he says to me, Mom, come on, they got me batting cleanup. I'm the fourth man out and I'm knocking him over the fence. Come on down, Mom, I want you to see me do this. And my conversation was, Keithy, get me a beer and I'll come down. And that boy will be 40 in October. And I have never seen him knock one over the fence. And I've got these parents, these spiritual people I'm telling you about, and they were not enablers. My father is calling me on Monday morning. They used to come out and visit on Friday. They brought the dog and they brought the suitcase and their bonds and stocks in a little box. They never left them at home. And they would come in on Friday night to spend the weekend with us. And, of course, you know, man, I got a drink. And they're watching this daughter. And finally on Sunday morning, they get up early and they go to Mass and they sneak on back home because they don't know what to say to me. And then my father calls me on Monday morning and he said, my God, girl, we don't understand your drinking. We didn't raise you to drink like that. Your brothers don't drink like that. You came home last night and you were stiff. We couldn't get you out of the car. And all I ever wanted to say to that beautiful man that was my father, Pop, I don't understand why I drink like this. Don't you understand that there is so little to me that the only time there is any peace in my life is when I take alcohol into me. And for that first 30 seconds, I'm whole. But what came out of my mouth is because I have laser lips when I drink. His old man, I don't get it. Why do you drive 52 miles to come out here and be appalled by me? And then my mother would cry and my father would be upset. And then I would get off the phone and I would have to drink because I was so ashamed and so guilty. And this is my life. I am 37 years old. I should be at the top of my game. And this is the best I could do. And I will never know why it came to pass for me. Except I believe in every fiber of my being. That old, old thing my mother used to read out of her big, big book that said, knock and the door is opened. Seek and ye shall find. And one night I'm sitting in my drinking chair, the chair that the stuffing's coming out of, and my ashtray's heaped, and I'm drinking, and I've been drinking and drinking. Ain't nothing special about this night. My God, isn't it wonderful that we don't know that this is a turning point in our life? Because I probably would have run screaming from it. The magic weenie, he's in bed. I'm raising three teenage boys. I never have to fight with my kids to go to bed. At 8 o'clock, it's lights out. My kids are all gone. He's gone. Even the dog has deserted me because I am no longer fun. I am the beast that sits in the chair. And we don't know if Mom is going to drink the rollicking beer tonight. Ho, 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 let's go to Puerto Rico. And I do. They don't know if Mom is drinking that nasty beer tonight where everybody is just annihilated by me. Sometimes I get lucky and get to drink that horny beer. I never know when it's coming, though. So you have to catch me quick. So I'm sitting in my chair in this little dirty house that I'm telling you that my soul has disappeared into, where there is no spirit song left in me. And I'm sitting there, and I have no idea what time it is. And I said to this thing that I no longer believed in, this thing I'd been given the finger to for years, but this thing that my mother had told me was a source of love and comfort. And I said to this thing, God, look at me, I'm a drunk. And then I followed it up with the second step. And I said, I don't want to be like this. And I got up and I went to my refrigerator and I got another beer and I opened the top and I saluted the ceiling because I knew God was up there in his heaven somewhere. And I said, see, I cannot stop. And I went back in my chair and I sat down and I finished that drunk. And I cannot tell you the time frame. I'm always dazzled by drunks that can say it was Thursday at 6:35. You know, it could have been 2 days. It could have been a week. I don't think it was anywhere near like a month. And I'm sitting in that same chair, and they're all in bed, and it's absolutely quiet. And I'm sitting there, and I'm drinking. And all of a sudden, Alcoholics Anonymous was whispered into my ear. I had never heard of you people. I had never read the Jack Alexander article. I come from a long line of the CIA, Catholic Irish Alcoholics. I am the only one in recovery. I mean, they're dying in my family like flies. My Uncle Wimp went out with ice water enemas and ice things down his throat. So, you know, we take it out hard. I got up from that little chair, and I went to the phone book, and I looked, and there you were. And I called, and a man said to me, you've just missed a meeting. But if you come on down here tomorrow night, there is a ladies' meeting at 8 o'clock. And maybe those gals can help you. And he told me where to find the place. And I hung up that phone and I sat down and I finished the drunk. Now, what I know happened for me, I grew up in the 60s when rocket flight and going to the moon and sending men in space was a new thing. I know today it's old hat, we do it, we bring them back, we send them back up again. But in the 60s, very new stuff. And they would talk, these scientists, about a window. And they would go to the services and they would pick the 10 top guys, most physically perfect specimens they could get. They would get these German scientists in and they would design this bomb, this bullet these guys were going to ride in. And they would take those guys and they'd put them in that thing and then they'd say, okay, now we got a window. And then all the guys, the weathermen, you know, they predicted this out here and everything had to be perfect. And they put the guy in the bomb and they shot him up. And if we were lucky, we brought him back. Sometimes not so lucky, but we brought him back. But what happened, you would get up at 5 o'clock in the morning. Everybody, you're up in your pajamas because we were all glued to these little tiny televisions to watch this in black and white every once in a while. Out over Florida, there would be a squall. There'd be a sandstorm in the Sahara. And this window that we're all waiting for would close. And all bets are off. And we would have to wait, sometimes hours, sometimes days, for this to all get better and the next window to open. I know what happened for me that night when I said, God, look at me, I'm a drunk and I don't want to be like this. I had a window. Newcomer, this may be the only window you will ever have. Some people have lots of windows. They're in, they're out, they're up, they're down. I don't know. I had one. I don't know if there's another window waiting for me. I know that window held for me from whatever that time frame was, I tell you, I don't know, till the night I called that man. And he said, in effect, we're holding the window for you. Well, the next morning I got up, and in the back of my mind, and I'm sick, I'm here in Alcoholics Anonymous, 8 o'clock tonight. Come on down. Maybe those gals can help you. And I get up, and I get the magic weenie off to work, and I get those three kids off to work, and I jump in, and I get ready for my day at work. I am a front office girl. I am a personal private secretary for my boss. And my uniform of the day is the Levi's I took off last night. I am wearing a sweatshirt with no sleeves and no brassiere because it was the 80s. We were all very free then. You know, I wasn't making a statement. I could just never find the damn thing. I had a pair of those black Zoris, those rubber things you wore between your toes. I had worn them so long that I no longer needed to wear them. I just looked like I had them on all the time. They were just so dirty on my feet. And I wore my hair parted straight down the middle in either two little pigtails, or I wore one of those three-quarter, you know, triangular scarves. And I got to tell you, I didn't want to look like that. I didn't want to have hair on my legs long enough to braid. See, I would come home from work, and I'd say, I'm going to get cleaned up tonight. And then I would get in that shower, and I would look at that beer outside the shower, and the shower went off. One time, I really got creative, and I put my shower cap on the beer, and that worked pretty well. Till I fell in the shower. Then I didn't do that anymore. So I was always going to get cleaned up. I was always going to wash my hair. I was always going to do something with my life. And the bottom line, it never happened. I drove off to work that day, driving down to town, thinking about what this man, and all day long I'm thinking about this ladies' meeting at 8 o'clock. Well, I worked for a lunch truck outfit, roach coach, as you guys probably call them. And you guys go up there and you buy your little sandwich and you get your cup of coffee or your soda and your cookie and you go back to work. What you don't know is on the other side of that truck, the side you never see, is all the booze in the world. And that's why I worked there. I would have paid my boss to let me work there. And so at 10 o'clock, the first truck would roll in and I'd be out there and I'd be charging Michael for what he took. And then I'd go around to the side and I'd have a beer while I'm doing it. And then at 12 o'clock, the rest of them would roll in and reload again, and I would go up and I'd hit all those trucks. So by 2 o'clock on my way home, I am half lit. And when you get to drink other people's stuff, that's really good drinking time, you know, when you don't have to pay for it. So I'm at work that day, and I'm doing what I always do. I'm hitting all the trucks up. But in the back of my mind, I am hearing that man's voice. And so I got home that night, and I rattled something around. I got dinner on the table, some sort of stuff. And now the magic weenie says to me, because if you live with an alcoholic, and I will talk to the Al-Anons now, you get the hell out of the house every chance you've got. So he was volunteering his life away. So at 7 o'clock, he says to me, I'm going to a Little League meeting, and out the door he went. And the three boys are like steps, they're laying on the floor watching television, and I'm watching the clock go around, and it's 7:30. And I said to the boys, I'm going to a Little League meeting. Now, I have no idea why they bought that. I just don't think they cared anymore. Just go. And I got in my little car, my little 75 Honda, and I started down for this place, this Serenity Club. This man told me that there were going to be women there that maybe could help me. And I drove down there, and I could not find it. Now, what I know today is this window that I'm telling you about, newcomer, that had been holding for me, is starting to close. And I can't find it. And I must have intuitively, at some level, knew that this was my only shot, because I turned that car around. I don't know why I didn't stop and just make a phone call. I drove 2.25 miles all the way back to my home. And I'm crying. And I ran in and I called a man and I said, I cannot find you people. He said, lady, you were there. Next time, park the car and get out. And so now my kids are paying attention because, you know, I've been doing some bizarre things lately. I get back in my car, and I'm crying, and I drive the 2.25 miles back to this place. I do exactly what the man says. I park my car, and I get out. I walk in the door, and the biggest woman I've ever seen in my life, she's 100 feet tall, she's 300 pounds, she walks up to me, and she sticks her hand out. It's a closed meeting, and I have no idea. And she said, my name is Patricia, and I am an alcoholic. Are you one, too? And I said the first honest thing I had said in 37 years of living. I said, Patricia, I don't know what an alcoholic is, but I know I'm a drunk. And she said, welcome. She had me by the hand, and my window closed. But I was safe. I was in my meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I sat there for that hour and a half and heard the love song that is Alcoholics Anonymous. See, I am finally enlightened. You have to hang around here long enough and do enough work to become an enlightened human being. So I had always heard my mother's holy man read from this book. And he used to say, the greatest gift one human soul can do for another is lay down their life. Now, what I thought that meant, because I wasn't enlightened, is Chris and I would be standing on a corner chatting at AA Talk, and a semi-truck would come around there, and I know it's going to hit us. I would throw Chris out of the way and take the hit. And I got to tell you, Chris, I'm going to miss you. See, but what happened for me in that meeting, six women laid their lives down for me. They had no idea what I was going to do with that information. I could have walked out of that meeting, walked into a bar and said, holy shit, you should have seen where I've just been. I could have gone home to the husband and said, man, oh man, wait till I tell you what I heard. This is the great gift of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we give it freely. We have no idea what you're going to do with it, newcomer. It's the idea. It's the joy of giving it to you. It's the absolute love song. It is the tuning fork at its finest pitch when I tell you who I am and what I had to do to get here and who I am today. And I sat there while they lit my cigarettes and they poured my coffee. And I walked out of that meeting and I knew that I had just touched the face of God. And I didn't know it was going to work for me. Now, they gave me the secret of Alcoholics Anonymous that night. And newcomer, listen up. Because if you're new like me, I always knew there was something going on that they were doing when I wasn't there. I knew there was a secret handshake or, something. If I could learn that, I could be like you. In Southern California, the phone company used to give us cases of these little paper phone books. And what those girls did for me, those six gals, they wrote their names there and their phone number, and they gave it to me, and they said, Marianne, call us. Maybe we can buy you 5 minutes before your next drink. This is the greatest gift I've ever had in my life. Nothing has compared to this gift. And I took it and I shoved it in my purse with old dirty Kleenexes, my car keys, gum wraps, because I had no idea, not being enlightened. And I went home, and the magic weenie's sitting there, and he ain't happy, because he's asked the kids, where's mom? And they said, ah, she's at a Little League meeting, and he knows. Yeah. He knows he's the only one this time in town, and he knows the kind of scrapes I've been getting into. That, you know, you drink that horny beer, you get in some serious scrapes. So he has no idea if I'm drinking that financial ruin beer tonight or, you know. He just waits to see what I'm going to bring home. The boys are up, and I walk in, and he says to me, where have you been? And I just went, I'll tell you later. And I am so grateful that that man allowed me to do that. And the boys went to bed, and he sat there, and he said, where have you been, and what have you been doing, and what do I have to do to clean it up? And I said, Tom, I've been to an AA meeting, and this monster, this thing that had been the source of all my ills, the contention in my life, sat there, and the tears ran down his face. And I went back on Friday night, drunk, and I went back on Saturday night drunk, and on Sunday morning I finally did this program the way it was suggested. It's 10 o'clock in the morning and I'm out in the driveway. The weenie, he's under a car, you know, feet up, working on something, and I'm looking at my watch because it's 5 minutes to 10, and I don't know about you, but I'm a union drinker. At 10 o'clock in the morning, any morning No time off for good or bad behavior. Christmas, it doesn't matter. At 10 o'clock, I drink. I don't drink at 5 minutes to 10 because I don't want anybody to call me an alcoholic. But I am in agony. I cannot wait 5 minutes after 10. And I'm out there, and he's there, and I'm dying. I am absolutely dying. And I walk in my house. Now, my refrigerator in my kitchen with all the beer in the world in it, because trust me, whether my children ate that day, had lunch money or shoes, my refrigerator had all the beer in the world in it, was there. My phone was down the hall in my bedroom on the left. And this is the great turning point. Instead of turning right and getting my 10 o'clock alcohol, I turned left and I went down that hall and I got that phone book out and I started through those names. Some of the gals weren't there, and I finally reached a lady named Polly. Polly was my third call because Polly wore flowers in her hair. And when you're the kind of alcoholic I am that I have just described, to see a woman that loves and cares enough about herself that she wears flowers in her hair, that was the most spiritual thing I'd ever seen in my life. And I called Polly, and I said, "Polly, this is Mary Ann." And she said, "Just a minute, honey, I'm cooking enchiladas." And I said, "No, I don't want to bother you." She said, "Just a minute, Mary Ann. Let me turn off my enchiladas." So for the newcomers, I also want to let you know this. The most spiritual food in the world is enchiladas. Had she been making spaghetti, I might not be here tonight. You may have another story. And I didn't want to bother her. I wanted to get off, and she turned off those enchiladas, and she picked up the phone, and she said, "Mary Ann, how can I help you today?" And I said, "Polly, how do you not drink today?" She said the most profound spiritual truth I've ever heard. She said, "Mary Ann, you put the plug in the jug, and if you need to call me every 5 minutes, you call me, and we'll talk." Now, my husband is a retired phone man, and he has talked to me about fiber optic cable. Fiber optic cable is thinner than your eyelash. And on this fiber optic cable, there's a bazillion phone calls going on. I got to tell you the power of God in my life. I'm in my bedroom in Home Gardens, California, and Polly is in 6 miles away in her city, Norco. And over this fiber optic cable, this thing that is thinner than my eyelash, God came through. And I hung up that phone. And from that day to this, I have not had a drink of alcohol. I do not know whatever happened to Polly. I lost sight of her. In California, we do a lot of moving around. But I will tell you this. I will look for her in heaven, and I will kneel at her feet because she gave me the day. You've got to have a first day to get 100 years. Oh, my God. I remember getting up that next morning and looking at my face in the mirror, this horribly ravaged face. I was swollen and bloated, and my face was red. My blood pressure was in my head. My hair was lank. I was dirty. I smelled. Booze was coming out of me. I was changing my sheets all night long, and I looked at me, and I winked because I had gone 24 hours. For the first time in 17 years, I had not had a drink of alcohol. This lady that I'm telling you about, this big, huge, gigantor woman, and I told you her name was Patricia. This woman became my sponsor. This woman took me through the steps the first time of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then she moved to Fredericksburg, Virginia, on the other side of the world. The chances of me ever seeing her again were slim to none. And in 2001, I got to tell you, we took a trip, and we got to stop and see her. I had this need. I kept saying to Otto, "I want to see Patricia. I need to see this lady." I had no idea where it came from. Because of the 11th step, I know I'm intuitive, and I never mess with that. When I get the feeling, I go with it. We drove clear across country, and this woman got out of the car. We were waiting at her house, and she was my size. In fact, I had 2 inches on her. I have 40 pounds on her. And I thought to myself, but you know what I saw, see, newcomer, is I saw the spirit in this woman. I saw Alcoholics Anonymous. She gave me a God so different. She would come up, she would give God the finger. She taught me more about prayer I told you I come from this spiritual Catholic family, and I'm not knocking the Catholics. I'm just telling you my family. We would get in the car to go to your house to a picnic. And we'd get in the car, and we would start to pray the Hail Mary. And we would pray all the way there, whether it was 6 miles or 600 miles. Then we would get out. We'd have a hell of a good time. Then we'd get back in our car, and we'd pray the Hail Mary all the way home again. So the first road trip I take with this sponsor, who drives like a man, you know, she cruises at 90, get out of the way, you SOB. Wow. You know, I'm one of those people, I close cover before striking, I mail early in the day, I always use a zip code. I mean, I'm, you know, and here she is. Anyway, I'm in the car with her, and we're driving along, and she's cruising at 95, 100 miles an hour. And she looks over and she says, because my lips are moving, and she says, what are you doing? And I said, I'm praying. And she said, well, that's commendable. And 30 minutes later, she looks over and my lips are still moving. And she said, so what are you doing now? And I said, I'm still praying. And she said, what are you praying for? And I said, I'm praying we get there safely. She said, Marianne, God is busy. We ask one time. And we leave it alone. The gentle teachers in Alcoholics Anonymous. The gentle teachers. I was struggling with something one time, an old spiritual Bob. Every meeting's got a spiritual Bob. They're so laid back. They are so in God's will. You know? And you always go to spiritual Bob when you're crazy. So one time I said, and I'm going on, and he said, Marianne, things are not visited on us. He said, it's to teach us to bend the knee. Wow. You know, all these great gifts I have been given in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I've got to tell you, sometimes the amends have to be made at a level we don't want to make them. Sometimes it is not enough to say, I'm going to change my life, and I'm going to try to live with you in a state of kindness and consideration. Sometimes the pain is at a level that the greatest gift you can give another human being is to let them go and to live their own life. And at 2.5 years sober, with my sponsor's permission, I walked away from the magic weenie. And he got to have a nice lady come into his life. And he got to live the next 14 years with a healthy woman. Merciful God, she was kind to him, and she was loving, and she did his laundry, you know, and she had food on the table, and she, you know, she managed his money, all the things I wanted to do. And at 60 years old, 3 years ago, he was mowing the lawn, perfect health, and he went down and he never got up. And I got to tell you, I wrote his eulogy. Don't tell me that we do not forgive in this program. The greatest gift is forgiveness. When I can forgive me, it just falls in line. At 5 years sober, I met my husband that I have now. I call him the AA White Knight. He always says to me, you never tell people I'm not the magic weenie. He says, men come up to me, are you the magic? So I'm telling you, no, he is the AA White Knight. He is a great and beautiful man. And we married in California, and he had always wanted to come back to Oregon. He has lived here as a kid and absolutely adored it. And so 14 years ago, we ran away from home and came up to Shady Cove, which is just on the outside of Medford, and we built the home we were going to die in. Why do alkies do that? We're not going to die. Christ, we're going to live forever. But we're always ready for the big casino, you know. Anyway, we build this beautiful home. We're living out there. There's deer, and there's squirrels, and there's every kind of animal you want. And I watch this man of mine. And this man goes out there, and I know he's a holy man. And the deer come down, and he feeds them out of his hand. And while he's doing it, he's picking the ticks off of them. He builds these incredible squirrel-proof bird feeders. Hasn't one yet. I want to get one of those little rubber stamps with a squirrel. You know how you can just like the... And we lived out there for 10 years, and it was wonderful for Otto because my husband is a builder. My husband can do anything. I do believe he was Noah in another life. I think Otto was probably the only man that isn't a cleric that knows what a cubit is. And so Otto was having the time of his life on this huge acre doing all the building, and I, who have been a suit from Southern California all my life, did not know what to do with myself. And time laid heavy. You know, I am an 11-step person, so, I mean, it wasn't that I wasn't doing the work. It's just I've always been a busy lady. And one day, Otto came home with a computer, and he said, it's time for us to get into the computer age. And, boy, I'll tell you, we crashed a few, but we finally figured it out. And we had these two granddaughters in Spokane. We have 14 grandbabies. I have a brand new one. He's 9 weeks old. His name is Zach. He puked down my brassiere, so I know he's mine. So I have him married all the way down to this little 9-week-old. But anyway, I have these granddaughters, little gals, up there in Spokane. And I would come, and they'd say, Grandma, tuck me in. And I would tell stories. I don't know where they came from. I would tell them stories. But, you know, grandkids are wonderful audiences. They don't care if it makes any sense. And I found it if I made great sound effects and little funny voices, they loved it, no matter what it was. Well, what happened is that they would say, I want a story about a Good and Plenty box. I mean, then they would give me homework, and then I'd be all day thinking, oh, my God, how to put this together. So my kids said to me, Mom, why don't you put these on tape so that we can have these stories for them to listen to? And, you know, I just don't do well. You know, this is a very hard thing for me. So with the coming of this computer, one day I sat down, and this story of a guardian angel appeared. And I shipped it off to those girls. And 3 days later, I sat down, and another story appeared. I got to tell you, they're not my stories. They come through me, but they're not of me. And all of a sudden, I had enough that I made a storybook that I sent to my grandbabies at Christmas time. And they just keep appearing, and I never know when they're going to come. But I have one story that I think belongs to us. It took me years to get it on paper. It would not take ink. It was just a verbal telling of the story. But not too long ago, I finally put it on paper. And it's the story of me and how I think I began and where I'm going to go. And I call it the becoming of Hiram. And it starts out as he has no idea where he is or how he came to be there. He knows it's dark. And it's cool, but it's not really uncomfortable. And so he waits. And in time, this little dark space starts to get too tight, and he wants to stretch, and he wants to move, but he's a little afraid. And he waits a little longer. And pretty soon, light starts finding its way in this little hole. And he can't stand it because the light is calling to him. And with one great push, he shoots up, and he's out of the dark place. And he finds out that he's a pumpkin and he's in a vegetable garden and an eggplant named Leroy. Says, welcome, Hiram. We've been waiting for you for a long time. And he gets to meet Ginger, the ear of corn. Now, see, I sponsor a gal named Ginger that has all this great hair. And she says, welcome, Hiram. We've been waiting for you for a long time. And they begin to tell Hiram about the becoming. And as they're starting this story, another vegetable walks into the garden. And this vegetable, his roots move. And he walks over and he sees Hiram. And Hiram feels this connection to this vegetable. And the vegetable wipes his face and says, welcome, Hiram. I've been waiting for you for a long time. And when he leaves, he says to Leroy, what kind of a vegetable? He said, honey, that wasn't a vegetable. That was man. And it's our job as vegetables to be the best we can be, to grow here in the summer sun and fill up, because we're food for man. Because only mankind has legs. Only mankind has the thought of God. And we give him food so he can use his roots to walk and to tell people about God. If we do not do our job, man dies, and all thought of God is gone forever. And as he waits there through the summer, he's terrified. All he knows is this becoming does not sound fun to him. It sounds like it's going to hurt. And as the days of summer come and he meets the Peapod kids, Ram, Lamb, Sam, and Sylvia, all his best friend is a stalk of celery named Josh, and they play 4th of July and all. And then the farmer begins to come, and one by one, all his people, he watches them leave. And he says, "Don't go, don't go." And they said, "No, honey, this is what I'm born to do. I'm born to become." And when Ginger goes, he almost dies. "Don't go, Ginger, don't go." And she says, "Sweetheart, look for me in the stars, because that's where I'll be." And Hiram is left with Leroy. And Leroy knows that he will go tomorrow. And he puts his leaf around Hiram and he pulls him close. And he says, "Don't be afraid. This is what you're born to do." And in the morning, the farmer comes and takes Leroy. And now Hiram is completely alone in this huge garden. And now it begins to get cold, and he has to cover up with his leaves at night. And the farmer comes with a jacket and a hat. And every morning the farmer comes in and thumps on Leroy's side and leaves. And Hiram hates the farmer now. And then one day, a very cold, frosty morning, the farmer comes down and with his knife, he separates Hiram from his roots and takes him into the house. And Hiram looks back at his world that was so huge, and he sees what a tiny speck of land this is that he has called his home. And the farmer takes Hiram in and passes him off to his Al-Anon wife. And she puts Hiram in the sink and she washes him with warm, soapy water. And she takes a big fluffy towel and she dries him. And Hiram goes, "Oh my God, what was I worried about? This is wonderful. If this is the becoming, why have I waited so long?" And then she comes at him with ink and she draws on him and it tickles. And Hiram is giggling. He's got all he can do to keep from laughing. And then she turns around and she has a knife. And Hiram says, "Oh my God, they're going to kill me." And she comes at Hiram and she sticks that knife in his head. And with that feeling, it is the most freeing. Oh, he goes, "What was I afraid of?" And she cuts his little eyes and his ears and his nose and his mouth, and he's starting to see and sense. And then she leans him over and she scrapes out all that crap, all that force that... out it comes. And then she saves the good stuff. Sixth and seventh step. Dries those seeds and throws away all that stuff that no longer works. And then at the dark time, they put a little candle in his tummy and they put Hiram out on the front porch for Halloween night. And he has become enlightened. And as he sits on the porch, he hears the wind through the trees. And with his new ears, he is overwhelmed with the sound of God. And with his eyes, he looks up and he sees the stars in the sky and he knows Ginger is there. And with his little mouth, he begins to sing his love song back to God. And at midnight, this light inside of Hiram flickers once, twice. And on the third flicker, it goes out, and Hiram is no more. And he has no idea where he is or how he came to be there. All he knows is it's dark and it's cool, but not particularly uncomfortable. And he waits. And soon a light begins to come into this dark place. And he hears a voice call his name, "Hiram, Hiram." And he says, "I'm here, I'm here." And the voice of God says, "Welcome home, Hiram. I've waited for you for a long time."